Well, this afternoon we're going to start talking about how to untangle all this and how to help people that have been spiritually abused and those kinds of things. Hopefully giving some help to you who have experienced that. In order to help people who have been abused spiritually or otherwise, who have lived through abusive situations, I think that there are two aspects that need to be addressed. The first aspect is the effects of that the abuse has had on the person. And those include the actual abuse, the fact that they've got extreme shame messages about themselves, that they have other kinds of wounds in their life. And then a term that I want to use, because I think it's actually really something that happens, is I think people get brainwashed. I think that when you try to deal with someone who's abused, who's been living in an abusive system and staying there, staying in the abusive system, there has to be an aspect of brainwashing that's taken place for them to be able to keep receiving this. You know, so when it comes time to recover, you just need to know, in terms of yourself or in terms of helping someone, that you have to almost like deprogram people. And the way that you do that is with graceful messages and graceful relationships that give people permission to be in the struggle. The second aspect, so the first aspect is the effects of the abuse. The second aspect in terms of recovery is that you have to deal with a person's predisposition to being abused. In other words, where and how were they set up to be abused? In previous situations or previous relationships, how did they become candidates to be victimized? Where did that happen? Because I really think that needs to be dealt with, or you're going to see it happen again and again. So it's almost like untangling the person's present mindset and the wounds that they have from this situation, and also going back and maybe untangling all that stuff too that set them up to be abused in the first place. Unfortunately, when you're looking at an abused person or a wounded person, most often what you're going to see are major behavior issues. I mean, this person is going to be shut down, for instance, or they're going to be acting out in angry ways, crooked angry ways, or whatever. It's going to be a messy thing. It's going to look messy. And because they're bleeding all over the place. And unfortunately, if these issues, which are behavior issues, if they surface in an abusive or in a performance-based place, people are dealt with on the basis of behaviors. And, of course, in a performance-based place, it's not okay to have these behaviors. So what's dealt with then is how to help people not to have the behaviors that are simply signaling that something's going on in the first place. It just treats the symptoms of the issue. There's a verse I want to share with you in the book of 2 Corinthians. And it's in chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4:7 says, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing greatness of power may be of God and not from ourselves." We have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing greatness of power may be of God and not of ourselves. Now, I think what this is saying is that God put the treasure in earthen vessels on purpose. Now, earthen is significant here because an earthen vessel would be like a clay vessel or whatever. And the thing about clay vessels, so that would be us. Clay vessels... is that if you drop them, they break. And if you bump them, they crack. They're weak. And what this verse is saying is that God has put his treasure in weak vessels, that if you bump them, they crack, or if you drop them, they break, so that when you see the powerful thing happen, you can tell it's God and not the vessel. So God is okay with weak, cracked, chipped vessels, you see. He's okay with that. In fact, he puts the treasure there on purpose so that you can tell it's him and not the vessel. And what I have seen a lot of people experience in church settings is that it hasn't been okay to be an earthen vessel. You're supposed to be a shiny, you know, gold or brass or silver vessel that only looked great on the outside because God's public relations depended on how shiny you were. And when I see people in that setting all bright and shiny like that, frankly, I can't tell where the power's coming from. I can't tell if it's God or if it's them. And so I sometimes think that I'm really looking at a person who's got a big will and not a big God. They've got a big will to look good, but they don't have a... And the message you get is God's not okay with your pain. God's not okay with your struggle. You know, God is the one who has the problem with you, and it isn't God who has the problem with you. Another verse that illustrates that God is not the one who has the problem with you is in 2 Corinthians 7, verse 5, it says... Paul says, for even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest. So what he's saying is, I am really tired. And he is saying, I am really tired in writing to thousands of years of Christians. Do you understand that? He's saying it out loud. We were really tired. We were afflicted on every side, conflicts without and fears within. Fears within. Now, this is the Apostle Paul saying it was a mess on the outside, it was a mess on the inside, and we were really tired. Now, see, if this were testimony time, what you'd have to say is conflicts without, but victory within. You know, you'd have to put it on. Even if there were fears within, you couldn't say that because it's not okay to have those things. It's some kind of spiritual indictment on you for having that. And then the next verse says, but God who comforts the depressed. But God who comforts the depressed comforted us by the coming of Titus, sent us a person. See, God did not have a problem with Paul's depression, let's call it that, because that's what he calls it. God's stance towards depressed people is comfort. But if you're in a performance-based system, you can't be depressed, you can't say you're tired, you can't have fears within, you can't be an earthen vessel. And so you get to keep all those issues and paste on this thing until you're so fried or shamed that you either shut down or disappear. It's not God who has a problem with people's pain. It's people who have a problem with people's pain. And so in a religiously abusive performance-based system, when people start doing these behaviors that are just symptomatic of the pain and the wounds that they have in the inside, they're dealt with on a behavioral basis. And what that looks like is this. First of all, the person who is the problem is identified and exposed. This is the process that this system would go through. To identify and expose the person who's the problem. So you're it, and we all know you, and now we all know that she did it. And you know, to bring her up front somehow, to make her sin public. What that does is it creates incredible pressure for you to change the behavior, though. The second thing is to focus on your performance, to focus on the performance that you're doing that isn't okay. Now, if you are being abusive, you know, to someone in the body, or you were leavening the body in a really hurtful way, I think that I would need to focus on your performance, okay, and talk about that and deal with that. But we'd even focus on your performance, for instance, if you chewed gum in church, or if you, you know, went shopping, or if you, I mean, the focus is on performances that don't matter. The focus is on performances that are benign, that are just your finding your way in life. And it doesn't have a leavening effect on anybody. It's just you doing what you do. And what happens is people's that private issues become public issues, and it's not okay. I'll illustrate this a little bit later. The third thing is, after you focus on the performance, what would be judged as an inappropriate performance in this system would not be abusiveness. Do you know why? Because abusiveness is what this system does. So we can't start screaming about how inappropriate your abusiveness is if we have an abusive system. Do you understand? The confrontation would come back on us. What we would say is the inappropriate performance is that you're struggling, or that you disagree, or that, you know, those are the performances that aren't okay to have here. But you could be hurtful to someone. You know, if you lack the fruit of the Spirit, no love, joy, peace, patience, you wouldn't get confronted for that. You get confronted for not reading your Bible enough, or not doing some external thing that everybody could notice, not coming to Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. Because that's how you can tell if people really love God, is that if they come to all those things, then you can tell. It's not a heart issue. Then the person, number three, is judged on the basis of the performance. But what you need to understand is, when someone makes a spiritual assessment of someone else based on their performance, they're also making a spiritual assessment of themselves. And the spiritual assessment that they're making of themselves is that they are okay because they don't do that. So for someone to judge you spiritually defective or inferior on the basis of you doing something, at the same time judges me spiritually okay because I don't do that. So there's a double-edged kind of thing happening here, you know. So The thing about I need to teach you a little bit about the concept of stumbling. You know, like what I was taught was if I dressed a certain way, that would cause somebody to stumble because they might dress the same way I did. Or if I drank alcohol, then somebody might drink alcohol, and I was causing them to stumble. What the concept of stumbling is out of my freedom doing things that cause people to stumble. What the stumble is, and I've done a word study on the word stumble, and there's the passage that summarizes it most clearly, the meaning of stumble every time you see it in the scripture is in Romans 9. What the stumble is in Romans 9, in Galatians 6, in Matthew 18, is that someone is just looking at Jesus and following him and depending on him and getting all their life and all their sense of identity from him, and they're walking toward him, going in the direction of Jesus, and then someone over here says, yeah, but you're supposed to do daily devotions more than you're doing. Okay? And what happens is that they take their eyes off of Jesus and don't look where they're going anymore, and they stumble. That's the stumble. And that is in Romans 9:30. What shall we say then, that the Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness attained righteousness, even the righteousness which is by faith? But Israel, pursuing the law of righteousness, did not arrive at that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it as though it were by faith, but as though it were by works, they stumbled. So, pursuing righteousness as though it were by works is stumbling. Now, of course, if I'm going toward Jesus and someone says over here, why don't you smoke a joint instead? And I go, oh, really? I'll stumble too. See, that is a stumble, and that's the traditional view of stumbling. You understand? Somebody pulls up in the black Cadillac, you know, with the charcoal windows and a Rocky Rococo suit on, you know, with sunglasses, and the thing comes down, and they hand your kids a joint, and they say, do this and you'll have life. Do this and you'll be okay. This will make you an important person. And if that gets them to not follow Jesus and do that, that's causing the little ones to stumble. But you know what? The stumblers in Matthew 18 aren't in a black Cadillac. They're in a white Cadillac with an Exodus bumper sticker in the back and a cross around their neck. And the window comes down and they say, memorize a bunch of verses and God will like you better. That's the stumble in Matthew 18. And Jesus says, don't be causing the little ones to stumble. Don't cause the little ones who believe in me to stumble. And remember, Matthew 18, the very first verse of Matthew 18 says, who is the greatest in the kingdom? So that's a how do you get points with God question. Causing people to be concerned with that question is causing them to stumble. And Jesus says, don't be causing the little ones to stumble. He takes that very seriously. It would be better for you that a heavy millstone be hung around your neck and you be drowned in the depth of the sea than for you to cause people who believe in me to take their eyes off of me and start looking at something else, which in this context would be earning points with God. Not doing a bunch of nasty stuff, you see, which is also a stumble. That also is a stumble. It'd be better off that they be, and of course there's two Greek words for millstone. One is the household variety millstone where you ground your own stuff, and then there's this big, you know, 2-ton millstone that the donkeys pushed around where you ground up the wheat outside in the yard. That's the millstone we're talking about in Matthew 18. Really heavy millstone. The depth of the sea in the Greek is the place in the ocean that's the farthest out where the water's the deepest and nobody ever goes. That would be better. Now, I have to back off from that and say something just about myself. I was a junior high pastor from 1975 to 77, and I wish that I could have every talk back that I ever gave. Every talk that I gave those junior hires was about getting them to perform in a certain Christian way so that their parents would think I was an okay junior high person. And I caused people to stumble for 2 years. And I wish I could take back every talk. There's a few tapes out there I wish I could get back to. I can't. Grace is extended to me on the basis of what Dave was talking about at the end of his session, where I can come to the point and say, no, there really is only one hope, that's Jesus, and repent from that and decide not to do that anymore and keep, you know, saying it really is about Jesus. But I still wish I could have all those talks back. Because I caused people to stumble. I caused people to look at something besides Jesus. And all the stuff that I got them looking at besides Jesus was good stuff, folks. I wasn't getting them to smoke dope or sleep around. I was getting them to do daily devotions. They were there to meet my needs. Can you see the upside downness of that? That junior high group was there to meet my needs. And junior hires aren't supposed to be here for junior high pastors. Junior high pastors are supposed to be here for junior hires. So after you focused on the performance and judge the person, then what you do is you apply pressure on the person to change the behavior. That's number four. You apply pressure on the person to change the behavior, or if they won't, you get rid of the person. And that's a behavioral approach to dealing with wounded people. Now, I want to suggest more of a systems approach to dealing with issues, more of a systems approach. And I'll get into systems more in a little bit, too. But here's a systems approach to dealing with problems. Here's some questions or concerns that you have when you're dealing with it as a system issue and not just an individual issue. One of the questions that's important to ask is, how have past relationship systems and present systems predisposed this person to acting this way? How did they get programmed? Where did this come from? You know, every behavior makes sense if you know where it comes from. The most bizarre, incredible behaviors that you can't understand why a person would act that way, if you knew where they came from, that would make perfect sense. Even, it wouldn't make it less bizarre, maybe, and it wouldn't make it okay. But everything makes sense if you know why. People are just doing what they have to do, or what they've learned to do. Doesn't make it okay, but it does make sense. So how does the present system they're in contribute to this issue? How does it add stress at the same time it takes away support? How does it add stress? Well, one of the ways it could add stress, for instance, would be to put the packages on the donkey and then tell the donkey it's not okay to be tired. Okay, keep adding jobs and then shaming people for feeling the weight of the jobs. That would add stress and take away support. You know, if you add stress, being in the ministry, being a Christian is stressful in and of itself. And if you're in a system that adds support in equal amounts to the amount of stress it adds, nobody burns out. But if it adds stress and also takes away support, meaning don't ask for help, that's not okay, then you end up with more wounded, broken people. How does the structure of the system contribute to the problem? That's what I talked about two nights ago about the authority and responsibility. If you have an organizational structure where you have one group of people that have all the authority and no responsibility, they get to decide how everything's done, but they don't have to do anything. And this other group who's got all the responsibility to do everything, but they don't get to decide how anything gets done, you will burn people out. It will burn people out. People will be abused by that. How do the dynamics in the church system contribute to the problem? How does the way we operate as a church system contribute to the problem? I alluded to the can't talk rule the other night. If you have a can't talk rule in the church system, then what will happen is everybody who thinks there's a problem is labeled the problem, and so everybody shuts up and you get to keep the problems. I remember the first business meeting I ever came to here at this church. And what happened is, I wasn't even a member, I was just checking it out, sitting in this thing. I just came out of working in a treatment center setting, where what we were doing there was teaching people to be brutally honest. It was an addiction treatment center. The message was, get honest or die. Okay, if you don't get honest, you're going to die. Get honest. So I'm sitting in this church business meeting, and this topic came up. And in the old days, there was a church governing structure where there were six people on the board. Three were from the same family. Father, son, and son-in-law were from the same family on this board. And the mother, the mother of the family, I think, ran the show, but she wasn't on the board because we also had a rule that said women couldn't be on the board, see? So she still called all the shots. And so we're in this business meeting, and we're discussing this issue, and this woman stands up, and she says, well, you know, there's a lot of people in this church who don't think we should do it this way. Okay, like this is the famous them, you know, the them, the they, who run things, but who don't ever show up at the meetings. So, you know, I don't know about all these rules that we got here, and I just came from this treatment center where it's get honest or die, right? So I said, who? She said, well, lots of people. I said, well, where are they? She said, well, they're not here. I said, well, how come? She said, they couldn't come. I said, well, do you think that we shouldn't do it this way? I mean, is your vote no? Do you think we shouldn't do it this way? She said, oh, no, I don't think we shouldn't do it this way. I think it would be okay if we did it this way. I said, so what you're doing is you're representing some opinions of people that aren't here that are contradictory to your own opinion. Like, you think it's okay, right? Yeah, I think it's okay. Well, then, if you think it's okay and the people who don't think it's okay aren't even here, you don't even have anything to say. You're not even speaking for yourself. Speak for yourself. The whole place turned around and looked at me. And I went, okay, wait a minute, okay? And I had people come up to me after the meeting and say, you know why people, those people aren't here? It's because of people like you are here. You know what that says? Shut up. Shut up. That was the message. Shut up. Can't talk. You're the problem, you see. And I kind of stumbled into that stuff. But that stuff controls churches. It governs, it decides ministry. It's not okay. How things look, the mentality of how things look, that God's public relations depends on how good we look. Poor God. Seriously, poor God. You know, what that does is it gets us pretending and only showing people the best we can scrape up and put out here, thinking God, the power of God depends on what people see in us. God can do his own PR, and as a matter of fact, he does it through vessels that if you break, if you drop them, they break, and if you bump them, they crack. And when it happens through us, I mean, take a look around. When it happens through us, you know there's a God, because it ain't us. Look around. We're just us, hanging on to God for dear life. If how things look is the most important thing, how things really are will not get dealt with. Guaranteed. If how things look is the most important thing, how things really are won't get dealt with. Now, all these questions I've asked so far are not even one single question about the individual who's having the problem behavior yet. Do you understand? We're asking questions of us, the system. What are we doing to help? What are we doing to not help? We've not even asked the question of the person yet. Those are system issues. We haven't talked about the person. Now we'll talk about the person. How have past relationship systems predisposed people to be unhealthy or to continue being abused or whatever, you know, past stuff, wounds in the past, things that are under the surface, deeper than what you can see. In other words, what help could we give that would really help? Not just get rid of the behavior, but how could we find out where this behavior, you know, because if you deal with the why, this is another thing that I believe. If you deal with the why, if you heal the why, the what will go away. If you deal with the why, the what will go away. And then the trick is to offer support and help and grace and rest and opportunities to go deeper to the person who needs the help. If they receive the help, you've won your brother. Understand? If they receive the help, you've entered into a process that's going to be an incredible process of healing and grace and recovery. If they won't receive the help, then you might have to do church discipline issues like what I've talked about, but only if the person's issues leaven the body. People can have their issues. One of the things I've learned about false gods is that they're false. So if someone's chasing a false god, sometimes if you want to convince them of their false god, you can't convince them by telling them that their god is false, you know, because they won't listen to you. So let them keep their false god. And after a while, guess what? Their false god will convince them that they're false. Why? It's false. It doesn't work. So lots of times I say to someone, I think it'd be good if you stopped doing that, but you want to keep doing that? Go for it. Try harder. Do it more. And I say that as much to people who use chemicals as I say it to people who are playing the church organ, thinking that if they just played the church organ enough, finally they'd be okay. Well, if playing a church organ can make you okay, if you think that, if that's how you get your points with God, I think you should probably play in two or three churches. Go for it. And they start going, boy, that sounds tiring to me. Yeah. But you don't think that yet, so go for it. Go do it. And when you get so tired that you realize you can't generate righteousness, come on back, I'll tell you about a gift. Now, in this session and the next session, I'm going to talk about how we get hooked, and we're going to try to entangle all this stuff I just talked about. This session, first session, is about the dynamics that trap us, the things in relationship systems that trap us. And I want to introduce the concept to you of psycho-emotional traps. And in a spiritual setting, in a religious setting, then we'll call these spiritual traps too. Psycho-emotional traps. Now, an example of a psycho-emotional trap, before I tell you, explain the dynamics of it, but an example of a psycho-emotional trap would be being put on hold on the telephone. Okay, you're on hold on the telephone. You're listening to elevator music on the telephone. Okay, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. And you've been on for 5 minutes, but you got this really important call you got to make. You got to talk to somebody, so you've been sitting there for 5 minutes. Then you think to yourself, I hate this. I don't have time for this. No way. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm hanging up. Then you think, well, I can't hang up because if I hang up, I have to call back and start over on hold. I'll just hang on a little bit longer. You know, and then the payoff, of course, is that this person is finally going to show up on the other end of the phone and not end up getting clicked off. You ever have that happen where you get clicked off? Okay, so what happens is you invest a couple more minutes on hold to try to rescue the 5 minutes you already put in on hold. Understand? That there's a trap kind of a thing. It's a concept that I call rescuing equity. Okay, I call it rescuing your equity. And rescuing equity is very very much alive in terms of a dynamic in spiritually abusive systems. Having a junker car. I had a 1972 LTD. When it hit 100,000 miles, everything started to fall off and break. The alternator fell off. Put a new alternator in it. That's $125. Brakes went, $150 for brakes. Then I said to myself, I hate this car. This car stinks. It reeks. It's sucking me dry. I hate this car. I got to sell this car. Then I thought, I can't sell this car. I got $275 in this car. I got to keep driving this car. So I keep driving the car. You know, the muffler falls off. That's $100. I think I got to hate this car. But now it's harder to sell the car than it was before because now I have $375 into the car instead of $275. Plus, I'll be darned if I'm going to sell this car to somebody else and let them enjoy all my new parts. I'm keeping this car, driving this. Now, that's called serving a car. Do you understand? That's called being trapped by a car. So I end up driving down the road in the car that I hate, that I'm having to preoccupy myself with, thinking about if something's going to fall off or break or whatever, feeling totally unsafe, doing a lot of emotional work about a car which is supposed to be a resource from the source to serve me. Now I'm serving the car. But I got so much equity in this car that I can't let it go. It's really hard for me to let it go. People do that with houses. We call them money pits. Okay, money pits. And it's about having to put more money in to rescue all the money you put in. People do it with unhealthy relationships. I've counseled people that have gotten married to rescue 4 years of lousy dating. Okay? 4 years of painful, lousy, terrible dating. And instead of saying, see ya, this didn't work. Okay, nice try. Bye. They get married to make the 4 years mean something, because if they walk, it means they've wasted 4 years. See, so it's easier just to get married and try to rescue the 4 years, and what happens is they end up with a more permanent version of the lousy dating relationship. It doesn't work. People do it with job situations. I hate this job. This job stinks. I've been here for 10 years. It's a dead-end job. I quit. Well, if you quit, you've lost 10 years. Okay, I will stay 6 more months, and if things don't turn around in 6 months, then I'm leaving. So you say stay 6 months. Now if you leave, you lose 10 years in 6 months. So it was easier to leave before. See, it gets harder and harder because you have more equity to rescue or lose if you leave. People do an unproductive therapy. People go to therapy as if they're working for the therapist instead of the therapist working for them. Therapists are employees. You can fire them if it doesn't work. But what happens is you go for 4 years, spend $10,000 on therapy and say, look, this didn't work, I'm leaving. That's really hard. So it's easier to keep going, hoping that something will click and it'll turn that whole thing around and make that $10,000 mean something, than to say, see ya, because you've lost your equity. See? People do that in churches. Because they've invested their lives there, they've invested their time there, their friends are there. People that they've been abused with are there. See? And they have this little group called the survivors of the Titanic that cling to each other. If you leave, you're leaving this group there, so you lose all that equity, you know, and you'll be the problem and you'll be unpopular, so it's easier just to stay, hoping that somehow God will intervene and send someone and it'll do something or whatever. I think Vietnam, you know, I mean, I'm not a, you know, pro-war or whatever, although I was. I protested Vietnam for quite a while before I enlisted. Different lecture. It's a different story. But see, what Vietnam was having to send more people there to justify having sent that many people there. Because if we just walk, we lost all those people for nothing. So we got to keep sending more and more. Now, there are some common denominators in situations that trap people. To make this a spiritual issue, I would say that the person who designs traps on a physical level, person who designs traps knows about the thing they're trying to trap and knows about traps. Okay? A person who designs traps has to know about how traps work, and they also know about the quarry. They have to know about the quarry. On a spiritual level, I think that the person who designs spiritual traps has to know about people that they're trying to trap, and they have to know about traps. And that's our enemy. That's Satan. Satan knows about traps. He knows about us. He's the accuser of the brethren. It's his job to steal our life. He steals and confuses and deceives. And that's all about traps. And so I'm going to show you some good traps, some characteristics that make a good physical trap, and then apply them in a spiritual way. Because there are some characteristics that have to be present to make a good spiritual trap. It's a curious thing. It's weird. It's gross. It's whatever. But it really makes sense with spiritual traps. First characteristic, first quality that makes a good effective trap is that it has to be able to lure the quarry. And not only does it have to be able to lure the quarry, but it has to be able to lure the quarry into acting in ways that risk its own well-being. It has to lure the quarry. A good trap has to lure the quarry into risking its own well-being. Now, what does someone use in a trap to get the quarry to risk its own well-being? What's it called? Bait. Use bait. So what they do is they put a worm on a fishing hook, and the fish goes toward the worm. That's the bait. So I wonder if there's a hook and a worm here. Just goes toward the worm. That's what bait does. Bait lures the quarry. Number two, a good trap permits travel in only one direction. It's omnidirectional. It only goes, is that right? Unidirectional. Yeah. Unidirectional. One direction. Okay, now that kind of trap would be a minnow trap. Those of you who grew up out in the country, maybe some of you city folks did this too, but probably not. You know, I don't know how many minnows there are in Minnehaha Creek, but it would be like, there used to be this kind of minnow trap that looked like this. Okay, it was like this, and it had a little funnel here, like that, and it was all screen. Okay, and then there was a funnel with a hole in the end of it, and what would happen is they'd put the bait, quality number one, they'd put the bait in here, soda crackers, put the bait in here, and the little fish would come along and look down this hole, and then at the end of this hole, they'd see the bait down there in the middle. So it'd swim down the hole, okay, not noticing, however, that this hole is getting smaller as they go in, okay, to get the bait. And when they got in the hole, when they turned around, they couldn't see the hole to get out. It would be like a barb on a hook. Barbs on hooks are pointed in one direction, so they go in easy, but they don't come out so easy. That's a good trap. So what happens is that if this bait gets the fish, for instance, to ignore the fact, I don't know if fish ignore things, okay, but not notice, I don't know if fish notice things either, I suppose, but it obscures the fact that the hole is getting smaller the farther they get into the hole. Because they're not looking at this stuff, they're just looking at the bait. So they're zeal or fervor to get that obscures lots of stuff they should be paying attention to. Number three, trying to get away traps more. That would be the barb again. You know, when the fish finally feels the hook, if it goes the opposite direction, it makes the hook go in more. Trying to get away, you know, a bear trap would be a trap with steel jaws like this, and when the bear puts its foot in, it clamps on the foot, and then when the bear pulls on its foot, it just makes the hooks dig in deeper. That's a good physical trap. Kind of gross, but I mean, that's what traps do. And the fourth characteristic is that traps have to be suited to the quarry. They're designed for specific quarry. Now, one example of that was in the 19th century, in order to trap wolves, to kill wolves, what they would do is they would take a knife blade and stick it in the ice in the middle of a lake, big long knife blade like this, razor sharp knife blade, and then they'd pour some blood all over it. And what would happen would be a pack of wolves would come and a wolf would lick the knife blade and it would start with, would bleed, and then the wolves would eat that wolf and have a big fight and they'd all eat each other. Pretty soon the whole wolf pack was destroyed itself because somebody knew that wolves really like blood a lot, so they figured out a way to do that. You understand? Somebody knew about wolves and they knew about how to trap wolves. Kind of, I don't know. It's ingenious, even if it is terrible. Even if it is awful, it's ingenious. Beaver traps. Now, what happens with beavers is that when beavers are placed in danger or when they feel fear, when they experience fear, what do? Anybody know? Slap their tail, and then what do? They dive. So what you do, trap a beaver, what they do is they take a little twig, you know, put a bunch of little tender shoots up by the shoreline. What's that called? Bait, okay, and then the water goes down like this. I'll draw this. The water goes down like this. Here's the bait. This. The water goes down like this. They put the trap right here for the beaver, like that, and then they tie a rock on it, on a string, like that. And the beaver sees the bait, goes toward the bait, gets trapped in the trap. Now, when beavers get afraid, what do? They dive. So this beaver dives. The rock rolls down the bottom of the lake, and then the rope doesn't reach the surface anymore. Then the beaver drowns, and then the guy goes and collects the beavers and doesn't have to shoot a bunch of holes in the pellet to get them. You understand? Somebody who designed that trap knows about beavers. Okay. Somebody who designs these traps knows about what they're trying to catch. Is this clear how this trap works? And then, of course, they just go around and hear all these beavers under the water about this far, and they take them up, and they've got their thing. Because they designed a trap custom made for the quarry that was trying to be trapped. Now, let's apply this spiritually. In a religiously abusive system, what's the bait? What would be some examples of bait? Holiness. What else? God's acceptance. What else? Fellowship. Peace. Freedom. You know, all good things, by the way. What else? Anything else you can think of? Pardon me? Yeah, earning. Oh, yeah. Jewels in your crown. What else? Ministry. People's acceptance. And some of the bait is like opposite of that. It would be like not being shunned or not being shamed or whatever. So there's the bait. What keeps people in unhealthy relationships is the bait of eventually having a good relationship, turning this into a good one. You know, or what keeps the bait in gambling is finally making the killing at the table. And the bait in Vietnam was the North Vietnamese finally surrendering and making this all mean something good, you know. The bait is the return of the person who puts you on hold. You know, that they eventually really are going to come back and you're going to get to have the conversation that you called to have. The second one would be about omnidirectional. What that means is that, or unidirectional, what that means is looking at the bait makes you ignore the stuff that you should be paying attention to, and so you get more trapped as time goes on and you can't tell. So how does that happen? What are some of the things, for instance, that you should be paying attention to that you ignore as you go in your headlong pursuit for holiness or God's acceptance or points with God or crowns or whatever? What are some of the things that you should be paying attention to that you don't?
Feelings.
Your feelings. How you feel. What else?
God's word.
God's word. God's word. Your tiredness. I firmly believe that when you are doing what God wants you to do, you won't get tired. Now, I'm not talking about like sleepy tired. You might get sleepy tired because hard work is hard. Okay. But if you're emotionally, spiritually, psychologically tired, then something's happening that shouldn't be happening. I'll say it a different way. When the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, when the fruit of the Spirit in your life is actually the fruit of the Spirit, instead of the fruit of you trying hard to do that list, like loving people you really can't stand and having joy even though you're miserable, you know, and saying praise God anyway even though you're sad, and gritting your teeth and tolerating your kids and calling it patience, and, you know, when you all that counterfeit stuff we do to earn somebody's approval. When the fruit of the Spirit really is the result of what the Spirit does, it doesn't make you tired. Counterfeiting the fruit of the Spirit makes you tired. So tiredness would be one of these things you're not paying attention to as you're going for this approval that's being held out there like a carrot. What would be something else that you might neglect?
Lack of relationship with God.
Lack of relationship with God. Okay, it would be more concerned about doing stuff for God than God Himself. Another thing might be what your friends are saying. You know, it's really interesting to me that at the beginning of a trapping situation, people initially are real concerned about how other people perceive their behaviors. They're real worried about what somebody else is going to think about what they're doing. So they pay really close attention to that. But what happens is that the more they get trapped, the less they're worried about what other people think, and they start ignoring that even more. So you ignore, you know, you got friends or family members that are saying, hey, I'm kind of worried about you. What's going on? You look kind of tired lately. You ignore it. And those are all little signals. Okay, the more resources that are expended, the more difficult it is to leave the situation. That would be more about the equity stuff. Okay, what is some of the equity that's hard to leave in a spiritually abusive place? Relationships you spent all kinds of time trying to build. What else?
Probably years you spent.
Years, time,
power.
Yeah, security. Security in a cage is still secure. You know, secure. Being a prisoner is still secure. Okay, it would be hard to give up the illusion that the bait really isn't good bait, or that this is never going to happen, or I would call that idealism of how it should be. You know, that was one of the biggest things that I experienced when I came out of seminary, because I had all these ideas of that the church and Christian families would be the best place for everybody to really get healthy and really talk the most about everything, and it really wasn't that much different than any place else. And that was hard for me to let that go. Okay, and then things about being suited to the quarry are this, that the person who makes the traps knows about traps and they know about the quarry they're trying to trap. And so what would be some of the characteristics in people that make them more easy to trap? Now, I'm going to spend a whole session on this right after this session, but what are some of the characteristics in people that make it easier to trap them? Being greedy. I think that prosperity theology gets people to give by appealing to their greed. Okay? It gets people to give by promising them that they're going to get. There's an interesting passage in Romans 11 that I want to read to you. And it's in Romans 11, 32, starting with 32. It says, "For God has shut up all in disobedience that he might show mercy to all." Now, what that's talking about is the fact that God designed a system that when you are compared to that system, or when you hold yourself up against that system, everybody who holds himself up against God's standard, the law, comes out disobedient, so that nobody can go to God on the basis of their own holiness or their own act being put together, but everybody who wants to can go to God on the basis of his mercy. His mercy is extended to everyone. So God thought of a system by which nobody can get to God unless it's just for free because of what God does. No one has an edge. In our systems, people have an edge. You know, men have an edge in our system, I think. People with money have an edge. People who are really good performers have an edge. I think when you go to a formula seminar, there's two groups of people that come out. Some people feeling pretty good because they can do the stuff, and some people feel really ashamed because they can't. So the people who can do it have the edge, and they're the ones who get to go to the advanced seminar, you know, later on. But in God's system, he created a system by which nobody can get to God on the basis of their own holiness, so that everybody who wants to can get there only on the basis of God's mercy that he extends. Then Paul kind of gets off on this system, and he kind of rushes a little bit about it, and he says this, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable are his ways." And what he's saying is, what a system. I mean, see, if I was going to do a system, how do you get to God? It would be bald guys get to God. Okay? And then I'd have an edge. See? And if man, in all of mankind's systems of how God likes you better, it all is based on somebody having an edge. You know, so you wouldn't have a system. I wouldn't have a system, for instance, that said long-haired people get to God. I would have a system that I can do. If you have someone in the pulpit screaming at you about short hair being a sin, you're not going to have a long-haired person screaming from the pulpit saying short hair is a sin. You're going to have a short-haired person. I mean, long hair is a sin. You have a short-haired person screaming that long hair is a sin because they have to follow their own system, you see, that says they're okay. But what Paul is saying is, who else but God would have thought of a system that nobody can get to unless God extends them mercy? What a system. What a great system. Everybody's even in that system. Then he says, who has known the mind of the Lord, or who became his counselor? Who has first given to God that it might be returned to him again? What's the answer to that? No one. No one first gives to God. No one first gives to God. Now, there are verses about, you know, getting rewards and all that kind of stuff, and I don't want to get into all of what I think the rewards mean, although I don't think that they're like if you do it right, when you get there, you'll have air conditioning in your room and these guys won't. Okay, I don't think that. Okay, I think the rewards in heaven are people. That's what I think. But regardless of that, what I know is that if you give, you get. It says that. If you do tenfold, you get a hundredfold back. That's a true thing. If you give, if you serve, there are rewards. The trick is, if you give to get, you don't get. No one first gives to God. God owes no one anything. If you do to get the reward, you don't get the reward because nobody gets God owing them anything. It is true that if you give, you do get. That's a true thing. But if that's the reason why you're doing it, you don't, because no one first gives to God. Plus, if you're given your 10% so God will give you 100% back again, you know, where do you think you got the 10% in the first place? No one first gives to God. God owes no one anything. God only does what he does on the basis of mercy and grace, never on the basis of owing. What are some other characteristics that would make people susceptible to being abused? Being really wounded would be another one. Being really wounded. Another one would be the need to save face or to look right, to be right or look good. How many of you saw the movie The Sting? Anybody see the movie The Sting? Okay, in the movie The Sting, this gangster from New York City gets cheated out of $40,000 in a poker game. Paul Newman cheats this guy out of $40,000 in a poker game and pretends to be drunk when he's not and insults him and just tears him down and makes fun of him and stuff, and he cheats him out of $40,000. Then what Paul Newman does is he leaks the information back to the guy that he was cheated, okay? So now this guy has a big need to save face and revenge and all those kinds of motives going on. And so later on, Paul Newman and his cronies get the guy to invest $400,000 to try to rip Paul Newman off to rescue the $40,000. And he ends up losing the $400,000 too. And that's The Sting. But it's because they knew something about this guy. See, the people who'd sprung that trap knew something about this guy. And if you know something about the guy, you can do a good trap on them. And the person who's trying to trap us and steal our joy knows something about us. And so a lot of traps that are, you know, what's interesting about that is I've had questions, and Dave said that he's been having questions too, you know, like, do these legalistic people know that they're doing this? Do the wolves know that they're wolves? I think the answer is sometimes they do know that they're wolves. But I also think that sometimes they don't. And an interesting passage is in Galatians 2:4, where it says, it was because of this fake brethren, the sham brethren, who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty. Now, what that means is that the legalistic people that Paul calls not really Christians, fake brethren, sneaked in to spy out our liberty, means they came into this group where grace is being preached, and the reason they came in spying out our liberty was so that they could watch where when you give someone grace, they fail then. You know, you give someone grace and they sin anyway, and then they can say, see, grace didn't work. So they're looking for places that grace doesn't work. They're looking to keep track of everybody who you set free under grace that still sinned after that or still did a bad thing, so they can say, see, you can't give people grace. You got to keep them under the law. But what's interesting about that verse, who had sneaked in, that phrase, who had sneaked in, is it doesn't say, it's a passive in the Greek, which means they didn't sneak in. Like, they didn't go, nyah-uh-uh, you know, I'm going to sneak in and spy out their liberty. It's a passive. It means they had been sneaked in. Okay, someone else sneaked them in. We were infiltrated by somebody who was placed there. You understand? Well, who do you suppose it could be who placed them there? Okay, so they were pawns of the enemy. They didn't even know they were doing that. They were pawns of the enemy who's there to steal our joy and put us back in the chains that Jesus died to take off of us. They hadn't sneaked in. They had been sneaked in. They were pawns. So some people don't know. They're just being pawns. They're working for the enemy and they don't even know it. What are some other characteristics? Having a lot of shame. See, people who have a lot of shame, then it's okay to treat people with shame in a shameful way because it lands okay. It doesn't feel wrong to them. It feels okay. Some people need to feel bad in order to feel good. Did you know that? In order to feel okay, they got to feel not okay. And so what that does is it predisposes them to being in a system that says they're not okay because that feels right. It feels comfortable. The idea that justice will triumph. If you have the idea that justice will triumph. You know, justice will triumph. It's going to happen. Okay, but it might not happen here. I might not see it. But it's going to happen. We win. I said that the other night. We win. But I might not see it. What I think is that the whole deal is kind of like a 9-inning baseball game. And in the first inning, that was the cross. God scored so many runs in the first inning that there's no way that Satan can score enough runs to win the game. So the game is over, but we still have to play the other 9 innings. And sometimes the enemy gets a bunch of runs. And that might be what we see. We might not see the end. We might not see the justice. So if you're staying in a situation believing that somehow God is going to intervene and turn the whole thing around and you'll be vindicated, maybe that'll happen and maybe that won't. I think I have seen that happen once where that's happened. But I stayed. But I stayed out of a very clear sense of God wanting me to stay, not wondering if I should stay or leave and maybe I'll just stay. A very clear sense that I need to stay. But then you have to not be naive about what that's like when you stay in that system. Because if you take the sheepskin off the wolf, they don't lick you. They bite you. So don't be naive about getting bit, because you're going to get bit. Here's how to avoid some traps. One is to set limits to your involvement. Like, know what you can do and what you can't do and what you're here to do and what you're not here to do. Set limits on your involvement. A verse that is kind of about this, I think it is about this, is in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 6 and 7. Now, in 1 Corinthians, you know, the Corinthians are kind of saying we get okay from Jesus plus the fact that we follow Paul. And this group is saying, well, yeah, well, we get okay from Jesus plus the fact that we follow Cephas, you know, and we follow Apollos, and that's what makes us special. And so we have the seeds of denominations already here in 1 Corinthians 3. And Paul reacts to that, and here's what he says. He says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God caused the growth. So you have to have a sense of what your job is. What your job isn't, though, is it's not to cause the growth. Your job is to plant, if that's your job, or it's to water, if that's your job, but God causes the growth. What that means is that if my job is to plant and I plant, and Joe's job is to water and he waters, and so I plant and he waters and God doesn't cause the growth, what does that mean? It means God didn't cause the growth. Why is there no growth? God didn't cause it. I planted, he watered, God didn't cause it. God's the one who causes it. So if it doesn't get caused, he didn't cause it. It doesn't mean I didn't plant. It doesn't mean he didn't water. It doesn't mean we should scramble around thinking that based on no growth, we should do a bunch of stuff to quick get the growth because now we're trying to cause the growth and that's not our job. Another passage that's about this, it's funny when I read this passage just in terms of how this landed on me, is in Matthew 9, verse 37, Matthew says, then he said to the disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. The harvest is great, but the workers are few. Now, the way that I was taught the rest of that was, so do more. Do more. Do twice as much. What the verse says is, the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. Ask God to send help. It doesn't say do more. Do what you're here to do. Do that. And ask God to send help. And you know what? I think that the harvest is always going to be plentiful and that the workers are always going to be few, and that's never going to change. It's never going to change. So ask God to send help. If you think that you're going to solve it by doing more, now you're in charge of the growth again. And you're not in charge of the growth. God's in charge of the growth. So set limits of your involvement. Number two, keep your spiritual boundaries intact. A way to say that would be remember who you are. Know who you are. In 1 Corinthians 4:3, Paul says, "But to me it's a very small thing that I should be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I don't even examine myself. I'm conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted. The one who examines me is the Lord." Now what Paul is saying is, it doesn't bother me that you examine me. Or actually he says it bothers me a little bit, but not that much. Okay? It bothers me a little bit that you're taking my inventory, but not that much. In fact, I don't even look at myself. Then he says, "I am conscious of nothing against myself," which means he has looked at himself. Okay, he has looked at himself, and when he looks, and which is my first inclination, by the way, when you start taking my inventory, is to look at myself and see if what's there is what you're talking about. See, he said, "But I looked and I couldn't find anything." But you know what? That's still not what acquits me. The fact that I couldn't find what you were talking about, that's not what acquits me. The one who examines me is the Lord. You got to remember who the one is that examines you. Now that doesn't mean nuts to what everybody thinks. Understand? Doesn't mean nuts to what everybody thinks. What it means is don't be blown to and fro by what everybody thinks. Listen to what people are saying. It matters what people think. It matters what they say. And the other part is take your stand spiritually and let what happens happen. Take your stand. In Galatians 2, what happened in Galatians 2 is that Peter came to Antioch. And when Peter came to Antioch, he lived like the Gentiles did. And he ate what the Gentiles were eating, and everything was great. No big deal. But then the Judaizers came, and what happened when they came is Peter got intimidated. He backed off of what he was doing and went over on their side, and a whole bunch of people followed with him. And here's what Paul says. "When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned." Now, "I opposed him to his face" means this, that the way that is in the Greek is that the point of attack came from Peter. Okay? Not that the point of attack. When Paul went and blasted Peter, he still thinks his perception is that Peter was the attacker because Peter was the one who left grace. You see? And when Paul withstood him to his face, he was withstanding the attack on grace, even though he was the one that was doing the confronting. The attack was coming from Peter because he condemned himself. Because he stood condemned means he brought condemnation on himself. "For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw, hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away. When I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all." Now, the reason why Peter's sin was exposed to everybody else is because his sin affected everybody else. And that's the only reason why you say something public like that, is if someone did something that affected the public. You don't go to your personal sin and expose it to people. It abuses them when you do that. And what he did was he made it a public issue because it was a public issue. Number three, get input from people outside the system. It doesn't mean find a different group of people to people please. It just means get a bunch of other input. Hear what other people are saying. See what it looks like from outside. And the last thing is to keep taking an inventory of how much you've invested. The problem with this is that when people are taking their inventory or counting the cost, what happens is if this is no investment, they invest here, way over to here. When they invest a little bit more, you know, I'll stay a little bit longer to make this turn out. They invest a little bit more. They only compare this new place to the place they left. See, to the place they just left. They don't say, "Wow, look how far I've come." And when they invest a little bit more, they only say, "Well, it's not that big of a deal. It's just a little bit more." See, and they compare it to the place they just left instead of saying, "Wow, look how far I've come." They don't compare it to normal. They don't compare it to health. They compare it to, compared to where they just were, it's not that big of a compromise. It's not that big of a moving my boundaries, no big deal. And so pretty soon they end up way out here a little bit at a time. Real far away from normal, real far away from health, incredibly invested, incredibly trapped.